if you're not here, excuse me, last week we were talking about Simon the Sorcerer, and we got down to the point as far as some specific situations that we might be involved with trying to restore someone who's fallen away. Now, you could probably replicate this in a lot of different ways and give 100 different situations, so there's no way to say, okay, it's always going to be like this, it's always going to be like that. But I did jot down about 6. And after thinking about the passages that we had prior to that, let's go back and think about some specific cases. Let's look at number 34. I bounced a contribution check. Everybody was told about it, so I don't want to come back. Think that's happened in some congregations?
You know, when I read that on there, I thought, that's terrible that everybody knew it. People should not know that.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but that's a fault of someone in the congregation that got that out.
And that, I think, opens up an important point, that sometimes something can become known to an individual, maybe a couple of people, and that information is transmitted wrongly by someone, in this case, someone who was counting the money, the treasurer, whoever that might be, and that has created such a problem in somebody's life that they've decided to stop coming. So we have to be cognizant of the fact, we need to be mindful of the fact that sometimes decisions that we make, things that we say, that can have some long-term repercussions. We might not be thinking initially just how far-reaching that comment, that statement might be, but we never know. Once the words are out of the mouth, there's no pulling them back. And that, in this case, might be a reason why somebody stops coming. So, yes, need to be very, very careful about that. What would you say to somebody who's bounced a contribution check? They're not coming anymore.
Please don't let that get away your salvation.
All right, I think that might be one thing. Can you think of some things that wouldn't be helpful? I mean, there's some things to say and some things not to say, right? Just about every set of circumstances, there are always some bad things to say. What would you not want to say?
Oh, well, everybody.
Yeah. Well, if you said that to me, then my question to you, if I bounced a check, my question to you might be what?
Have you done it?
Well, that's...
And did everybody know it?
Yes. Yeah, you might hear that. What else? Somebody's bounced a check. Judy?
I think I would go up and ask that person or apologize for the gossip going around and then ask that person if I would be able to help them until they got straightened around.
All right. You know, back to Bonnie's point. We had a problem. The problem is not so much with you. The problem was with us. We had this issue come up, and that should have been resolved. The check could have been represented at the bank, and that should not have been an issue. That does happen from time to time. And we have a situation in place. Now, if it's like something else, a matter comes up, you think about what has happened in Florida, they say that shouldn't have happened with all the police deputies and so forth. From this point forward, what are we going to do? We have a new program. We have a new system in place. Might you want to change some things around? Might you want to change your treasurer? Yes. You might want to make sure that you have a protocol in place for if a check is bounced, then you have an automatic procedure that it's going to be submitted to the bank. Maybe you work that out with the bank. Maybe you do that manually, whatever that might be. But again, try to think through that. Try to put yourself in the place of the person who has done that. And then, too, bear in mind the kind of person that you're dealing with. And I don't mean that in a bad way. But if a person is not coming back because he or she refused to bounce a check, what would that suggest to you as far as the degree of their faith? Yeah, they're probably on the lower end of the spiritually mature scale. If you have someone who is a mature Christian, not anything that they're going to be really happy about for a lot of reasons, but still, likely that's not going to cause them to leave the faith. But if you have someone who is struggling, kind of like Judy was saying a little bit ago, maybe finances are really tight for a period of time, they're working a few hours, whatever it might be, can we help you? We're here to see if we can offer some assistance.
Yeah.
So try to do...
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Sometimes our paycheck does not get into the bank in time, like you get it on Friday.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be processed until Monday. And so sometimes you think you've got enough money in there, but
a little short.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's humiliating to have everybody know about it.
Anybody else on that point? All right, let's move down to the next one. This is 35. My child was bullied by other children, and we're never going to be back. Now we step it up a little bit, don't we? It's no longer a bounce check. Now my child has been bullied.
Now, not only is it me, now my kids mean it.
Yes. Now we have another family member as well. So what do you say?
Did you report that to somebody?
All right.
So that that could be addressed and fixed.
Well, let's take that two different directions. Somebody says yes. I went to the elders. They didn't do anything.
Maybe they should have started with the parents.
How did they know they didn't do anything?
All right.
Right.
You're doing some investigation here. You're trying to figure out, just like you would with a doctor or nurse, you're trying to, you know, look at the symptoms of the problem and get some more information. You're trying to look at it like a police detective and see what happened. Not that we're trying to, you know, play 100 questions, but did this happen? Did that happen? Did you try this? Did you try that? And you might find that a person simply says no. When you're dealing with someone who has fallen away, there are cases, a lot of cases, where a person is just looking for an excuse, aren't they? And they will come up with 100 different excuses. And you might be able to show that every excuse is not true. Or everything has been done to try to deal with the situation. And the person has just decided, I don't want to be involved with Christianity anymore. And they're going to say this, that, or the other thing. But what about in a case where a child is really bullied?
Take the parents and the child to the elders. And have a pallet on the desk.
Well, but your child is not doing the bullying. Now, if that were the case, then that might be a different set of circumstances.
No,
but in this case, yeah, you're going to be the victim, or your child is going to be the victim. So.
My child's perfect.
Okay, well, there would be some parents who would make that argument. What else? Your child is bullied.
Your child is bullied
at services. So what do you do?
Well, if it's very public, anybody could go up to the parents of the child who's doing the bullying and bring it to their attention, I would think.
Some parents,
I wouldn't hesitate.
Some parents think their kids do believe you.
Yeah, I know, but yeah, you still, isn't it your duty? If it's a public thing, you might want to go over and pay attention to Johnny. I think there might be something going on over there. I mean, you wouldn't have to say, hey, your kid's bullying so-and-so. You better, what are you going to do about it? I mean, there's several different approaches you can take to it. Couldn't you?
When you think about a child who's bullied, is it usually just one time and the parent is all up and unhappy? Bullying is usually a process, isn't it? It starts and then it continues. So if it is a congregational problem, again, good old Barney Fife, what did he say? Nip it where?
In the bud.
You go back and you try to get a hold of that early and figure that out, step on it, and crush it. Therese?
I think as a parent, in our situation, I've watched closely, and I saw it happen. And I was thinking, well, I actually went to the child and talked to them, and it stopped. But we also involved the elders. I mean, they were aware of the situation, but I think we just have to watch and help where we can. And it takes a village. If I were to see somebody picking on any child here, I would step in. I'm sorry.
I would too.
Or if they're misbehaving, I would still.
But it's a lot easier in a congregation sometimes of under 100 compared to a congregation of 300 or 400 or 500. But still, the principles still apply, regardless of size. Anybody else? Okay, let's take a look at item number 3. You have an unloving church. No one ever talks to me because I'm not part of a clique. I'm not going back. I'm not loved.
The opposite of that happened here. There was a visitor, and when I talked to her, she was so overwhelmed with people coming up and greeting her and shaking her hand and asking her name and telling her that she was welcome and so on. And she's never been back. It goes the opposite direction.
Yeah, you can. Are people going to be closer in some congregations to some others than others? Sure. You might have people, they are in the same business. You know, if you have somebody who's working at a factory, they might be able to relate to somebody else who's doing factory work, maybe not in that same building, maybe not with the same company. If you have some young parents, they naturally are going to probably have some things in common with people who are raising kids. If you have some people who have come to the point of retirement, they're probably going to have some things more in common with people who are also at that time in life. So nothing wrong with having special friends, nothing wrong with having close friends. But when you have a situation where you have a clique, what's a clique? You see it. Girls at the mall, what do you find? Their clique? School? What's a clique? All right, this is our group, and when we are with our group, and we're always with our group, who's not welcome? You're an outsider. You are not welcome. Now, can you sometimes see that there is a situation, maybe not in a local congregation, where you have some people involved, and it's probably not the best time to go up and involve yourself in the conversation? What body language would indicate that to you?
Everybody's facing in.
All right, you've got a group where two people or maybe three people are kind of huddled together, and that's probably not the time to go in and investigate that group. But you know, when you have some people, the body language is open, and it doesn't look like that you have that closed group. Can you go up and join in that conversation? Sure. So you have here, let's go back to our question again. You have an unloving church. No one ever talks to me because I'm not part of a clique. What do you say? You go out to visit, Trish? Many does not necessarily equate to friendliness.
Mm-hmm. Or everybody.
Yeah.
Because nobody talked to you didn't mean that they weren't talking to somebody.
That's true too.
And all these people were sitting around wondering why nobody talked to them too.
We as a family, my sister and her husband and children, and Stan and I and our children, and another family member, we were all visiting in that town. So we all got up on Sunday and went to visit a Church of Christ congregation in that city. And so we made quite the impact. I mean, there were 10, 12 of us maybe that arrived that morning. We walked in, we sat down, and we sat there, and not one person before, after, any time asked us if we were visiting, who we were, you know, did we live there, anything. Didn't say hello, how are you, nothing. And we were trying to impress this family member with this church.
Yeah.
And guess what? Never went back there.
So we know the problem when it comes to a lack of friendliness. Most of us have experienced that at some point, maybe in our local area, maybe when we're visiting somewhere. But what happens when we go to visit somebody and they say, the congregation where you attend, the congregation I've been attending for a while, it is not friendly. What do we say? How do we deal with that? Well, okay, you know, that might be one response. I mean,
if they come late and leave early, then you have to gently point out to them that they're not going to make friends if they don't talk.
Is that fair? Is that fair to say to somebody you leave first thing and you come in late?
Yes.
Well, it is fair, isn't it? Part of the problem is you, Now, you don't have to shout it at them, but, you know, it does help to say, look, you know, you have a limited number of people back there, and by the time you come in, just about everybody is seated, maybe the worship has started, and we get to the last amen, and you're halfway out the door. It is a little difficult to communicate with you.
I said, on those lines, you have to be tactful when you're talking to them, but you ask them, what makes you say that?
Mm-hmm.
And give me the reasons, and if you come to find out they are arriving late, leaving earlier, they're staying away from people. It's like, it's not that we're unfriendly, you know, you just, you know, give us a chance here.
Remember what we said about 5 minutes ago? If somebody doesn't want to come, somebody doesn't want to participate, what will they always find? They will find an excuse, and they will go through every excuse in the book. Now, I don't feel too badly if I talk to somebody, they say, well, I'm not coming, or I'm not going to come for this, this, and this reason. If we've looked at that reason, and we've tried to resolve the issue, and they say, well, still I don't want to come, and then there's this, and then there's this, and then there's this, I feel badly that they don't want to come. But ultimately, I have to realize that the problem is not with us, the problem is with you. And sometimes that's where the problem has to be put. It's on their shoulders, it's on your shoulders, it's not on my shoulders or the congregation's shoulders. Jeff and Rita.
It seems like today's society in which we live in, nobody wants to take blame for anything, no matter how clear that blame can be ascribed.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, excuse or whatever.
Yeah. The blame game has been popular. Adam and Eve began there, and it's continued till the present time. Rita? Some of this is on your shoulders. And if there's some things that we can correct, let us know. But you also have to be part of the process and help in the solution. Is that it? Marcia?
One of the things you could say to them is that, well, try it one more time, and you come and I'll sit with you and we'll see what we can do about this.
Yeah.
Then if they say no, 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 or have an excuse for that, then it's like, okay, you just don't want to come.
That's good. The other thing I think that you can toss in there, what if you have a congregation across town? There have been times where I've recommended that if you don't think that this is a good fit for you, there's another congregation across town. Maybe it's closer to you. Maybe they're larger. Maybe they have this when it comes to kids, or maybe they have that. And, you know, not necessarily that I'm going to be in a position to walk you over there, but, you know, that's an option for you. And usually, if that option is put on the table, what do you hear?
There's
going to be another, well, no, for whatever reason. And again, that is a telltale sign that it's not really a problem with you. The problem is with them.
I was just going to say, that would be another solution to that. They bounce the check if there was another congregation.
Sure.
If you feel like you can never face those people again here, try over there.
Well, they know. You know, and they're going to come up, like I say, with something oftentimes, but yes. If it's going to be that petty. Therese, did you have a thought?
Well, actually, yes. that's a raise of my hand. In a factory, we have quality control, and I like that you said if somebody brings up an excuse or whatever, or they say, I think it's good that you're aware of it, other people are aware of it, and we investigate. Is this legitimate? Do we need to fix something? I like that.
Yeah. Well, we have to. You know, Paul talked about examining ourselves in the context of Lord's Supper, and that should be something that we're always trying to do, because we can make improvements. And if we're strong in an area, then okay, we know that we've covered this particular area. Okay, let's look at point number 37. Somebody says, look, I work 6 days a week. Sunday is my only day for rest. Would that be true for some people?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Especially when times get busy. What do you say? Well, all right. Sunday nap works for some people. What else?
Come rest with the Lord.
All right.
What did she say?
Rest with the Lord. What else? Well, one of my questions might be, are you working 6 days a week because that's required or because you want the money? You think there are people who work 6 days a week sometimes because they want the extra income on Saturday or the extra income on Sunday? Sure. They'll pay me double. They'll pay me triple time. Well, that might be really good money, but what are you sacrificing in order to get the extra pay? There were a couple ends.
Your salvation.
All right. Yeah. What else might you say to somebody who says, look, I work 6 days a week. Sunday's my only day of rest. Good for you. That was what I was hoping that somebody would bring out. But we meet again on Sunday evenings at 6 o'clock. We're here for 40, 45 minutes. And that's probably not going to be too late by the time you get home to get a decent night's rest. So at least you can come out on Sunday nights. Very few people over the years have said, well, yes, I'm going to be a Sunday nighter. I'm going to come out on Sunday evenings. But that is possible. What if you had a congregation where somebody said, look, that's really a difficulty for me. What would you think of a congregation that said we're going to move our second service to the afternoon? Just for this Christian. We're going to have a 2 o'clock service because Joe works 6 days a week.
Means that in place of the 6 o'clock
yes.
service?
So do that every Sunday is what you're saying?
Yep. You wouldn't help Joe out?
I don't think it would. Do you think it would?
No, I'm asking. If Joe said, look, I can't make the 9 o'clock, I can't make the 6 o'clock, I could make 2.
If he would really come to.
Yeah, I think some churches would find it to try it.
Yeah, I don't see anything wrong with doing it. I don't know if Joe's going to come at 2.
Yeah, but let's assume that Joe really would come at 2 because he's going to be up and around. Or what if you had some other Christians who said, look, we'll meet at 2 with Joe. We'll have a worship service. Not everybody can maybe come. There might be some of the Christians that are come at 6, but we're going to have, just like you have a nursing home service. Could you do that for Joe?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. A lot of things that can be done. So when you come back, you can offer sometimes some solutions for people. And again, it's really going to put them on the spot as far as whether or not they're going to accept it. All right, somebody else says, I don't fit in here. Why might a person say that? They've worshipped at a congregation for a while and they finally say, I don't fit in here. Why say that?
You need to check with them and say, why do you feel like you don't fit in?
Okay, let's put that on the back burner for a second. Why might a person say that?
It could be that this personality-wise, don't fit
in. All right, sure. Maybe he's really outgoing. Congregation is kind of introverted or vice versa. That might be one personality. Why else? I don't feel like I fit in.
Their beliefs, they feel, are different than mine.
Okay. Have some different beliefs. What's another reason?
Racial differences.
All right. Some racial differences.
Age.
Age differences. You have an old congregation and you have a young person or vice versa. What else? All right, they feel like they're excluded for various reasons. What about the way people dress? They all dress very well. I'm not able to do that, or vice versa. Now, back to Betty's point.
You're going to ask them, what is it that causes them to feel like they don't fit in?
Okay.
And start investigating from
that. All right, person says, well, here's my reason, or here are my reasons. How can we overcome that? What should be the responsibility of the congregation before that person leaves the rails?
Let them know that you want to be their friend.
Yeah. We're reaching out to you. You might be old and we're young. You might be well-dressed and we're not. You might have the money to go out to eat every Sunday. We don't. Whatever the differences are, that's fine. We're reaching out to you. And with that reaching out, you begin to eliminate some of the problems like we're talking about today. All right, 39. I'm sorry.
Sorry. You know, it might be a really easy excuse. I don't fit in here. I mean, that could cover a multitude of perceived problems, I suppose. Just at the end of the day, it's an excuse. I don't fit in.
Yeah.
It's simple to say that and hard to quantify it from the other end.
Yeah. And you have excuse after excuse when it comes to people leaving the faith. And it's tough to reclaim them because people get something in their head like that and they just, you know, I can go through the list as far as people that have told me this and that over the years, and you can reason with them, discuss things with them, and they just seem loath to change. 39, I did something really bad and don't believe God can forgive me or don't believe that they would welcome me back. You think there's some people who have left the church for that reason?
Yes.
I mean, you can just go down the list, bang, 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 as far as sin. And sometimes it gets a little worse. A person will say, well, my name was in the newspaper. Did you see it? I made the local news. Did you see it? What would you say?
No, I don't read this.
Well, all right, that might not help you out very much. It might age you a little. But what do you say?
Well, if you're comfortable with it, you could share with them something that you're not proud of.
All right.
You know, say, if you struggled with it, say, I struggled with it for a little bit. If you didn't, just say, there are people here who want to help you, who love you, no matter what, and show them that God forgives, you know.
Okay. We're in the same boat, aren't we? We're all sinners. Maybe you made the news, maybe not. But we're all on the same playing field. We're all guilty of sin. So that's a good thought. What else might we say, Bunny?
There's really no degrees of sin. You sin or, I mean, I went out and shot someone and you went out and stole something out of the store. Both of us still sin. Others might be different consequences, but sin is sin. So maybe you could point that out to them, that we've all sinned, fell short of the glory of God.
What about when you look at people like the Corinthians? And such were some of you, fornicators, adulterers, idolaters, revilers. Now, Paul didn't list names, but we know where those people were. They were Christians at Corinth. I mean, he comes out and is pretty specific. And those people have been in the book for a long time, haven't they? 2,000 plus years. So again, the question becomes, are you going to let this set of circumstances do what? Separate you from God. Right now, who's driving your life? God or the devil? The devil's directing your life. And as long as you persist in this path, you're headed towards him and his kingdom. You need to seriously think about what you're doing. Somebody comes along and says, point 40, I no longer believe in God. How do you think some people, if they were talking to an individual, might react to that? I no longer believe in God. You think somebody might just be tempted to give them hellfire and damnation sermon? Why? How can you think that? Even an idiot believes in God. Well, that's probably not the right time for that. I think a good approach would be to just kind of take a deep breath, step back for a little bit, and begin asking some questions. You know, sometimes we think that we can know where somebody is as far as their mental process, or we know what they need. But oftentimes, what we think we know is not right. So if we step back and ask some questions, what do you mean? What do you believe by that? What did you previously believe about God? What has caused you to stop believing in God? You know, where do you think, you know, the things that Kitty mentioned as far as nature came from? Do you think that everything evolved? What goes back to the first cause and so forth? And sometimes some well-placed questions are helpful. That was one of the useful things to me in life was, before you go off on a tangent, try to understand where people are coming from, because you can relate that to all the things that we talked about before. Well, I'm not loved at the congregation where you attend, or my kids are being bullied. You might, as you hear that word, my kids are being bullied, what comes to your mind? Sounds like somebody's being beaten up, doesn't it? But somebody says, well, you know, he raised his voice at my child. Well, that's probably not going to be my definition of bullied. So when you tell me something, I want to make sure, especially in these kinds of circumstances, that I understand exactly what you're saying before we start trying to look at the problem and maybe come up with some solutions. Tracy, do you have a thought? Okay. Anybody else want to contribute something there? Marcia and then Bonnie.
I was just going to say one of the experiences that we had is that we encouraged somebody, they were taught, we did not live near them at the time. They were baptized, became Christians, and 6 weeks later, her brother died in a tragic accident. And her response was, so did my brother go to heaven? Well, your brother was an adult, and we don't know that. You know, we tried. If that's the way God is, then I don't want to have anything to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
My brother did. I didn't get a chance to tell my brother about being baptized and how to be a Christian, and he died. And now, what do I do? You know. So that's very, very hard thing to do.
Yeah, you're going to have sometimes people with an agenda. And as you go see them, they're going to pound that agenda and they're not going to let it go. And the visit is not going to go very well. Again, because their heart is set on a particular path and that's what they're committed to, regardless of what you say. And you have, I think, with the Jesus and the Jews, the same kind of thing. The Jews' heart was set on a certain path, and even the Lord was not able to turn that back sometimes. The last item. I've become a double worshiper. Now, you might wonder, oh, I stuck that in there, but I've got a reason for that. Somebody comes along and says, well, I've become a double worshiper. The chance of that's probably pretty small as far as being true. But why do you think a person might say something like that? All right. I'm going to try to shock the person. I know he's going to come over, and I'm just going to throw that up at him. You think there's some people who will try to shock you if you try to visit with them and try to restore them? They're just going to come up with the weirdest, what do you believe about UFOs? I've had some people do that to me over the years. Or what about extraterrestrials? I need that question answered before I come back to God. They will come out with the wildest things that you can imagine. Again, it's not that they really want to come back. It's not that they want to have a discussion. It's you're here, and what's my goal? I'm going to drive you away. I'm going to distract. I'm going to come up with the weirdest stuff that I can ask and deflect from the real issue. Well, again, if that's what you want to do while I'm there, man has free will, doesn't he? You've got free choice. And if you want to waste the time, if you want to play games, if you want to mess around, okay, then you've answered my question as far as whether or not you have an interest in considering God. But always try to hold out hope for people and do the best that we can. Anything that you want to add or ask over the items that we discussed? Yeah, and the weirder it is, the quicker some people seem to be prone to pick it up. And like I say, it's really sad, but they've got their shot to discuss things with a Christian if they so choose. That it? Okay, let's go back and think about some things from Acts chapter 8. We're just about ready for Acts chapter 8 and verse 25. We've got Simon. He's been described as being in the bond of sin. He's there in the gall of iniquity. Verses 22 to 24, he's told to repent of his wickedness, pray to the Lord if perhaps the thought of his heart would be forgiven. And then in 23, he says, this is Peter and John, I see that thou art in the gall of bitterness, the bond of iniquity. Simon answers, he says, pray ye for me, the Lord, that none of these things which ye have spoken come upon me. Luke does not say if Peter and John prayed for Simon or not. I'd like to think that they did. I'd like to think that he was sincere. There's no reason that I can find to believe that they rejected his request. But if Simon was not sincere, if he was playing the kinds of games that we were talking about just a few minutes ago, they certainly could have refused to pray for him. We do know that when we think about intercessory prayer, that this was something that they were familiar with. You have intercessory prayer mentioned in the Old Testament. You've got it in Abraham's life. You've got it in the life of Moses, Samuel. And in the New Testament, you think about intercessory prayer. Remember in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5 and verse 44, Jesus said, if you have an enemy, be willing to do what for him? Be willing to pray for your enemies. If you're praying for your enemies, are you making an intercessory prayer? You are. So Jesus taught that. You're going to see that a little bit later in Acts chapter 12, intercessory prayer as well. You have intercessory prayer for fellow Christians. 1 Timothy chapter 2, 1 and 2 talks about intercessory prayer for government leaders. And it's just really throughout the scripture. In Acts chapter 8 and verse 25, let's get down and look at least a little bit of the text today. The 25th verse says, "They therefore, when they had testified and spoken the word of the Lord, returned to Jerusalem and preached the gospel to many villages of the Samaritans." Jerusalem at this time was still sort of the base of operations for the apostles. So you have Luke saying they, that would be Peter and John. They testified as well as preached. We're going to look at that word testify today in the morning lesson. That's going to be looked at in some detail. I'll mention to you in that sermon that we have that word being used for the first time in Luke chapter 16 and verse 28. The rich man who went to the Hadean realm, he wanted some testifying done to his relatives back home. One source said in the book of Acts, the term is used as a special expression for proclamation. Here it's joined with the word of the Lord, repentance, faith in Christ, the gospel of peace, and the kingdom in other places in the book of Acts. When you start looking at Acts, you have a lot of teaching, you have a lot of preaching that was done. The church, the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2, that started with preaching and teaching. Acts chapter 2 and verse 14, you've got teaching or preaching in Acts 3, Acts 4, Acts 5, Acts 6, Acts 7, and now here in Acts 8 as well. Earlier in Acts chapter 8, we remember, I think, how Philip goes down and he's proclaiming unto them Christ. That would be Acts chapter 8 and verse 5. A little later in the chapter, anybody remember who Philip is going to go down and preach to, talk to? His Bible study is with? All right, he's going to be with the Ethiopian eunuch. And you have there in Acts 8 and verse 35, he picks up that prophecy from Isaiah. He opens his mouth and he preaches Jesus unto that eunuch. Then you have Saul of Tarsus. He's going to be converted in Acts chapter 9. And the Bible says in Acts 9 and verse 20, he immediately began to proclaim Jesus is the Christ. He was the Son of God. Peter and John, as you look in Acts 8, 25, where do they go? They go into many villages. That's an important word for a couple of reasons. That described a word, it described a small town which did not have walls. That word is also used back when you look at Jesus' ministry. It's Matthew chapter 9 and verse 35. And it's kind of interesting. When you think about small towns, now, again, it's not so much of an issue for us, but they had small towns without walls. Why would you have walls in some communities?
Protection.
All right, protection. You go into the big city, like Jerusalem, or you go into a big place and you're going to have your army, and as invaders come, you can find protection and water and food. But if you are, you know, out there, typically you're going to be in the community, you're going to be in the farming village and so forth, and that's where you live unless there's going to be some kind of big catastrophe coming. Well, Jesus had gone to those rural areas, and I think there's a lesson there. When you think about that, the church, as it existed in the first century, we can look at large cities in our state. We certainly have at least two of them, three, depending on how you count things. But also when you look at some of the smaller communities. Had this been in the first century, establish a congregation here, another little city, another little community or town, establish a congregation there and so forth. And that's what they did, trying to get a congregation of God's people in many, many different areas. Anything that you want to add or ask before I make a couple more points? Okay. The Apostle John, he's working with Peter here in Acts chapter 8, and this is the last time that we really read about him in the book of Acts, let alone the Bible. Now, I do know that he wrote 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, and of course the book of Jude and the book of John, but this is the last time that we have him mentioned as a character. There's a brief allusion to him in Acts chapter 12, but he sort of fades out of the picture at this point, and it's kind of interesting, at least to me, that he fades out here, because you remember, John, he was one of the fellas. They go to the Samaritan village. They're not received very well. And what does he want to do? He wants to call down fire from heaven and consume who? The Samaritans. So at that point, he's not on very good terms with the Samaritans. But now what's he doing? He's in the area of Samaria. And he's preaching, he's teaching the Samaritans to become Christians. So it's almost like Luke decided this was going to be a good place to end the information about him. So John kind of drops out. Again, you have that Acts 12 allusion and the books that he wrote. But aside from that, he sort of drops out of the picture. Acts chapter 9 and verse 26, there the Bible says, "But an angel of the Lord spoke unto Philip, saying, Arise and go south unto the way that goeth down from Jerusalem unto Gaza, the same is desert." That's going to get us into some new material. That's going to be a good stopping point. Anything that you want to add or ask before we wrap up today's class? Okay, let's end it there, and we'll have a couple extra minutes. Thank you very much.